Noises and shouting laughter came from the pub. My old Peugeot was alone in the car park. With my back to the dark space behind me, I fumbled for the keys, fear briefly prickling in my mouth. Once inside, my other life was instantly present in the smell of dog, mud, and wetsuits. It reminded me of the fullness of our lives. What we had was hard won, but most of the time I knew we were lucky. There was a tattered sheet of maths homework on the floor and a pair of trainers stuffed under the front seat. I found a jelly sweet in a crumpled cellophane bag jammed into the side pocket. It tasted sugary and sharp. I turned on the ignition and eased the car forward. 4. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. In the fields near the cottage, the dense scent of earth, sharply cut with grass, brings the memory of children playing late in a darkening garden. Or is it the smell of funerals? Naomi's face floats in the grey space in front of me, her cheeks shadowy, as if in a box. Quick, think of the sea whose sound is following us. But the distant suck and splash becomes a heartbeat. At 6 weeks, she was all heart. I'd sneaked an early scan, but the translucent throbbing muscle on the screen had made me tense even then. How could it not get exhausted? Later, checking some childhood cough, my ear pressed against her perfect skin, I had heard that fast bird beat. Was it conceivable that she realized at the end, if there had been an end, that her heart was slowing? Is there enough blood in a dying brain to register that the heart has stopped? My feet catch against the jutting root of a tree, and my head hits hard against the roughened trunk. I'd forgotten the shock of physical pain. Chilly in the elephant's eye. I used to keep a supply of bandages in the airing cupboard. The dusty shelves are full of old blankets, but at the back my fingers close over the little cloth bag. Once she fell off the garden wall, tearing her scalp. When I brushed her silky hair at 5, I could see the tiny scar on her scalp. Was she hit on the head? Scalp wounds can be fatal so quickly. I thought I was done with this torture, but this is a bad day when thoughts slide along memories, sharpening them like knives. I quickly clean the cut, pat it dry, and pull the edges together with Steri-Strips. As I finish, Bertie noses into my leg, whining softly. I've forgotten to feed him, and the steadying little ritual of opening the tin, spooning dog food into his bowl, mixing in biscuits, restores the evening's normality. It was the same back then. Bristol, 2009. 17 days before. The pile of ironing on the stove was warm under my hand, and the fat orange heads of a bunch of chrysanthemums glowed against the black outside the windows. A peppery smell of meat scented the kitchen from the casserole I had left to cook slowly all day. Bertie pushed his head against my leg, and the day began to lose its grip. I fed him and took him out. As he scuffed in the blown leaves and drank from puddles, lights glowed from the windows of the houses we passed. I caught the gleaming edge of a bookcase in one, in another a table set with shining glasses. It was hard to imagine that these perfect houses had cupboards somewhere like the one we had at home, stuffed with bits of alarm clocks, old keys, computer leads, and mugs with broken handles. As I passed the last house, someone inside closed the tall wooden shutters. The downs at the end of our road led to a grassy stretch above the Clifton Suspension Bridge. The steel girders had vanished in the dark, and the fragile light-beaded strands looked as if they were floating. A memory glittered like the river far below. The bright sea in Corfu had shone with a million broken points of sun last summer. Swimming, I had glimpsed darkness beneath me shelving down into depths, and terror had crawled at the edges of my scalp. If I forgot how to make the automatic movements that kept me afloat, I would sink, drifting unseen and helpless into darkness, hands grasping on emptiness. I had turned on my back and swum to the rocks, sitting on the rough grey surface, surrounded by the rasp of cicadas and the scent of thyme. The heat had seared away the fear. Pulling Bertie after me, I began to hurry home, my feet echoing on the pavement. It wasn't possible to forget automatic movements, that was the point. Your body remembered. The twins were playing their guitars, sprawled on the window seat. Ed nodded briefly, his shoulders hunched, his long fingers flicking over the strings. He had grown this year, thinning out so the bones of his face were angular under the skin, his cheeks becoming hollow. As I stared at him, absorbing the changes that still surprised me, his eyes looked quickly away from mine, and I remembered that he had tried to call me. "Sorry I missed your call, darling. I wanted to phone back, but there was an emergency. Maybe leave a message at reception another time, or wait till I get home." Ed shrugged. I couldn't tell what he was thinking, but then I hadn't for a while now. I couldn't even remember when we'd last had a conversation. Naomi had been quieter too. I paused as I took my coat off. Was that what happened as children grew? A process so gradual that in the future I would never be able to pinpoint the exact moment when I became just a figure in their hinterland, watching from a distance. My eyes went to Theo, head back and eyes closed. He was strumming and singing loudly, tie half off, his art books scattered over the floor amid toast crumbs. He looked up suddenly and grinned, his wide mouth splitting his freckled face. I wanted to hug him. Theo was at least still Theo, jokey, uncomplicated, and happy. Ed was watching, so I smiled at both of them. They had always been different, though they'd had exactly the same love and attention. Perhaps it proved the point that character is predetermined. I liked that explanation. It let me off the hook. 4 ounces of butter and 4 ounces of sugar, soft drift of flour, brilliant yellow egg yolks, sharp white apple flesh cut into the tin, batter poured on top, into the oven. Another kind of automatic, coloured in and scented. The back door crashed open.
"Hey, doggy!"
Naomi, in a belted black coat, bent over Bertie.
"Did you miss me, then?"
Her fair hair fell forward in a shining sheet onto his nose, and he sneezed noisily. She looked up, but her smile faded when she saw me by the stove, and she didn't return mine. Her voice was sharp.
"I know what you're going to say, but don't bother. I'll do homework backstage. I can't miss rehearsals. Going to change!"
I wasn't going to say anything about homework. I was stung. "But if you've got lots..." She turned silently, and then she was climbing upstairs with dragging footsteps. A distant door slammed. She used to race up those stairs. She was tired. I sliced the tops off beans. They were still her favourite, tossed in butter with a sprinkling of roasted almonds. Tired and edgy. The play rehearsals were relentless on top of GCSEs. The boys gathered books, drifted to the stairs, talking. Theo quietly mocking Ed, something about girls, low-voiced, so I wouldn't hear. Peace, then. The safe feeling of children home and doors shut against the night. I drained the potatoes and beat them into soft clouds, made Naomi sandwiches to keep her going, and prepared a thermos of hot chocolate. I'd save her some supper. Jade Price's image hovered in the warm kitchen for a moment. She looked so thin this afternoon. I wondered whether anyone would be giving her supper. The back doorbell rang. Naomi's friends collecting her on the way to rehearsal. She came back through the kitchen and then disappeared amidst a welter of young voices. Upstairs, the front door opened. Car keys rattled onto a table. Quick footsteps came down the stairs into the kitchen. "You smell of hospitals," I murmured, my cheek against Ted's rough, cold one. The sharp tang of disinfectant always clung to him when he first came home, layered under the faintest scent of lavender from the theatre scrub. I wanted to stay close, but he drew back and smiled, looking over my shoulder.
Hey, that looks good.
He leant past me to break off a fragment of warm sponge, and then bent to pull a wine bottle off the rack. He poured two glasses and held one out.
How was your day? He asked.
There was a shine of excitement on him, so I didn't tell him about the bruised child, Naomi's irritation, or that I had remembered how it felt to be in the sea, out of my depth.
Fine, I said. What about yours?
Fantastic. The child's completely better. Lots of international interest. The press has been phoning the hospital all day.
He started pacing, unable to keep still, running his fingers through his hair so it stuck up in blonde clumps. As I watched him, the thermos on the table caught my eye, left behind with the neat little packet of sandwiches.
She's stopped screaming. No more hallucinations.
He looked at me, blue eyes shining.
An operation to cure psychotic symptoms. It's a groundbreaker.
At supper, Theo's freckled face and Ed's darker one lifted, dipped, and lifted, eating, looking up at Ted. He took us through the tense moments of delicate probing to destroy disordered cells deep in the brain. The child had presented classic symptoms of psychosis with paranoid delusions. On the ward, she had thrown scalding water on other children and bitten nurses. Today, after the operation, she was drawing flowers. The phone rang, the Daily Mail wanting to know about this new miracle cure. Ted took the phone upstairs to talk.
Theo pretended to drill Ed's head with the blunt end of the fork.
I'm going to cure you once and for all.
Before Ed could escape, Theo had pushed him off the chair and wrestled him to the ground, shouting,
The voice is in my head telling me to kill you.
If you go away now and do your homework, I'll let you off the washing up. That kind of deal usually worked. Theo, have you shown Dad your art project yet?
Which one?
Man's Place in Nature. He's bound to see it in the exhibition.
I can't. He'll kill me.
Darling, just get it over with.
Once they had gone, the kitchen felt drained of noise. I began to gather the smeared plates. Ed had left most of his. Too much toast earlier. I was still there when Naomi came slowly through the door, an hour later than I thought she would.
How did it go?
I asked, looking at the dark shadows under her eyes.
Fine.
A smile hovered. I waited for a little story about someone joking around. Maybe the director was pleased with her singing, or the way she said her lines. I watched her pull off her coat, pour herself a glass of milk, and lean against the stove to drink it. She seemed to be somewhere very far away. She looked sideways at me, not fully meeting my gaze. As she headed towards the stairs, I couldn't help myself.
So, what happened?
Stuff. I'm tired.
Once she would have followed me around, a flow of talk, questions, doubts, jokes. I would have had to tell her I needed space to sort emails, but she would have followed me to my desk, sat on the arm of the sofa, carried on talking. Now that seemed a long time ago. As she brushed past me, there was the faintest scent of something acrid. Tobacco.
Naomi?
She turned impatiently.
You haven't been smoking, have you?
Her blue gaze seemed clearer than usual. She shook her head.
Izzy was smoking in the changing room afterwards. She was upset because Mrs. Mears kept going on at her about her lines, so...
Naomi shrugged.
Where's Dad?
I stared at her for a moment. I didn't believe her, but I would know if she was habitually smoking. Her clothes would smell of tobacco. She would be coughing. One cigarette really wasn't a big deal. I let it pass.
The great neurosurgeon is in his study, fielding the world's press, I replied.
She started going up the stairs.
Aren't you hungry, sweetie? You forgot...
But she disappeared into the shadows at the top of the stairs. 5. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. I forget when I last touched anyone, or was touched. I kissed Naomi's hand in the kitchen a year ago. The warmth of Theo's rough hug last Christmas has long faded. I see Ed every month, but he avoids the slightest brush against me. Ted and I shared a bed till I left, but we lay apart, facing away from each other. In the nursing homes I used to visit on my rounds, the residents sat beached at the rim of a room, old hands reaching for mine, greedy for contact. Now I've turned it round. Not touching has become a scrupulous act. I take care to avoid the accidental touch of fingers in the shop as the man gives me my change. If someone comes to the door, I step back. So when I see the old lady lying across the steps of her bungalow as I come back up the lane one afternoon, I am surprised how automatic it is to reach out to her. Her skin is white, but her pulse is full and regular. My hand on her chest lifts and falls. Beneath her eyelids, the pupils are equal in size. She looks so peaceful that I hesitate, wondering how to rouse her without startling her. I know that jolt into reality. Though sometimes, I was glad of it. Bristol, 2009, 16 days before. I woke with a sudden start. In my dreams, I had been tumbling through space full of harsh voices and the relentless fall of water. There had been tapping, coming closer. Jade was crying somewhere. The relief of morning seeped into me gradually. The crying became the call of gulls, blown inland by the wind. There was a magpie outside our window, chattering as he swayed in the empty lime tree branches. The twiggy ends were tapping against the window. Somewhere in the house above me, Naomi must have been having her morning shower. The water would be falling around her in a shining column. I curled my feet around Ted's and watched him as he drifted lighter in sleep. His cheeks were looser than they used to be. The light picked out grey flecks in the blonde where the hair feathered into his neck. I moved closer, shaping myself round him. Our bodies felt warm and safe together. The frightening dream melted away. We'd planted two lime trees close together 18 years ago when we knew I was pregnant with twins. We had a competition to see whose grew the fastest, but in the end they had twisted together into one huge trunk. Even the branches were entwined. In the summer, the morning light in our room was stained green, but at this time of year, twigs filled the space with black crossing lines. Ted made a content waking sound. He always woke happy. His hand felt hot on my shoulder and moved slowly down my arm, then to my back, pulling me close in. Our faces touched, his mouth on my cheek. The radio switched itself on, cued to start at 7. Tuesday, the 3rd of November, the voice told me. I had to get up now. I needed to catch the paediatrician and I was on call. Regret and guilt slipped round me like a familiar coat. Sorry, I kicked back the duvet. Sorry. I'll put the kettle on. His footsteps went slowly down the stairs. His voice came back up, sounding distant. The bright hot water around me in the bath was soothing. No harm done, I thought, as I watched Ted's calm face while he cleaned his teeth. I sipped the dark coffee he had brought me. It doesn't matter. We talked through our day to come, my visit to Jade Price, Ted's clinic, and the lecture he would give after that for the students. He paced onto the landing and back as he dried after his shower, thinking, talking. Suddenly he caught sight of the posters for Theo's art project stacked outside his bedroom door ready for laminating at school. He stopped abruptly and, crouching down, began to leaf through. So Theo hadn't shown them to him last night. He was keeping his head down. They were a series of Naomi in autumn woods in the Brecon Beacons, taken on different Sundays in October. Each time the trees lost more leaves, Naomi had taken more clothes off. At first just her gloves, then her shoes, her coat and her jersey. Ted whistled in admiration at the way Theo had captured the shapes and colours of autumn, and Naomi's pale face glowing against the trees. He grew quieter as he worked his way down the series. In the end, Naomi was naked, caught hidden within twigs. Her eyes stared out, darkly challenging the viewer. I sensed Ted's dismay in his silence. Sweetheart, I stood behind him, wrapped in a towel, my feet puddling the wood. I know what you're thinking.
You don't know what I'm thinking, he said quietly.
It's a metaphor. If we open ourselves to the natural world, shed our sophisticated layers, it will protect us in turn. I know, Theo.
Stop saying you know, everyone. You don't.
His voice got louder.
It's got bugger all to do with the natural world. He's exploiting her, making a series of risque photos to get attention. She's too young to see that, but surely you can.
Ted, it's art.
I can't believe you'd use that cliched excuse for pornography.
It's not pornography.
My voice was rising too. She was wearing knickers, for God's sake. She kept her coat on until she was hidden. Nikita was there. Naomi threw her clothes out to her as she undressed.
I paused for breath. How could he think Theo would exploit her?
He and Naomi had always been the closest out of the three children, even when they were little. You're missing the point again, he said curtly.
I stepped back from the fight. There was no time.
Let's talk about it tonight with Theo. Nothing more to say, he shrugged.
Time had run out. Arguments were often left unfinished and seemed to disappear, untended bonfires burning out, leaving only a pile of ashes behind. Ted, with clothes on, was harder, surer, walked quicker. He gave me a kiss which missed my mouth, his eyes somewhere else, the door shut behind him. Naomi appeared as I was gathering my bags together. She still looked tired despite the night's sleep, and moved around the kitchen slowly finding folders, scarf, and hockey boots. She seemed absorbed in the day to come, and didn't look at me when I suggested breakfast.
Not hungry, she said briefly, knotting her scarf as she watched herself in the little mirror on the wall by the phone. Have something, darling. Toast? An egg?
She wrinkled her nose in disgust without replying, and then bent to the dog.
Love you, Bertie.
She kissed the air above his head and left. The door slammed. She came back for her mobile and left again. The boys appeared, sleepy and silent. Ed looked dishevelled, with unknotted tie and half-combed hair. He poured muesli and ate it slowly, reading the side of the packet with concentration. Theo leant against the fridge door, eating the rest of the apple cake, his eyes closed. Then they left, bumping shoulders as they went out of the door together, both carrying Theo's art folder, shoulders hunched. It was time for me to leave. I followed them, but turned at the door, sucked back by the warm disorder. Teeth marks in the buttered rind of toast, a glittery pool of spilt sugar, bent packets, open jars. I wanted to stay, shut the mess into cupboards, and restore order to the surfaces. My mother, as her younger self, seemed to be watching from the shadows behind the hanging coats in the lobby, so close I could feel her breath behind my neck, her chin on my shoulder. She was telling me to stay, tidy up and keep watch as she had done. I quickly pulled the stacks of shoes apart until I found the new red ones with heels. I put them on, becoming the professional, the doctor, and I slammed the door shut behind me. Outside, I met Anya being dropped off by her husband. Under her coat was the patterned apron she wore to clean our house. She always worked calmly, her gentle hands honouring each task. No matter how hard I tried, I ended up pushing at things angrily, running from one unfinished job to the next. She and her husband came from Poland. Whenever I saw him, he scowled at me. I wanted to tell him that Anya made my life possible, but that would have made him angrier, as if my life was more valuable than hers. His hostile glance flickered over my warm coat, the leather bag, the tall house behind me. As I unlocked the car, I waved to Mrs. Moore opposite. She was putting out her small packages for recycling. Ted had left ours on the pavement last night. The rinsed bottles of Shiraz, the exotic cardboard sleeves from Ready Meals, copies of the Telegraph folded neatly edge to edge. Mrs. Moore straightened up, her hand in the small of her back. She looked towards me, and her old mouth cracked open briefly. I could just see the soft shape of her son Harold as he bobbed uncertainly in the bay window. He was about 30, with Down syndrome. Her husband had left years before. I wondered, as I did whenever I saw her, what kept her going day after day. She was still staring at me as I started the engine and pushed the knob of the radio, and it came to me unexpectedly that it could be the other way round. Perhaps I needn't feel guilty about how much more I seemed to have than she did. She watched me rush in and out. She would know how late Ted came home from work every day. She might even feel sorry for me. The morning slid away quickly. Three women, one after the other, derailed by the mess of ordinary biology, periods, pregnancy, menopause. As I listened and examined, I wanted to tell them that this was normal life, not illness. In other cultures, there might be celebrations. Perhaps I was the celebrant here, providing recognition in these rites of passage. The last patient, though, Mr. Potter, was really ill. Aged 90, he had polished his shoes, walked down the hill, and waited his turn to tell me he had left-sided central crushing chest pain. I looked at his sweaty face, at the smile he was attempting that trembled on his lips. There wasn't much time.
"Sorry, doctor. I didn't know. I thought it was indigestion. I didn't want to bother you."
He spoke with difficulty, gasping for breath.
"Who will feed my cat?"
He used the phone to speak to neighbours while I organised his admission to coronary care. He was changing worlds. Behind him was his tiny, clean council flat, the faded wedding photos on the brick mantelpiece, the flare of the gas fire with the empty chair opposite his, and the warm presence of a little cat. Ahead of him was a place of high, bright lights, tubes and bleeping monitors. The staff around the desk would be too far away, or too close, breathing into his face, or talking to him as if he were a deaf child. I wanted to tell him to wear his war medals. Frank sat behind a leather-topped antique desk, making phone calls. He lifted his eyebrows, smiled, and nodded at the chair. There were two mugs of coffee on the desk in front of him, the fragrance filling the room. I sat down. He replaced the receiver and sighed, wrapping large hands round one of the mugs. His glasses were askew. No bit of desk was visible beneath the rubble of instruments, pens and forms. There had been a bureaucratic cock-up by the PCT, apparently, which meant appraisals were changing again. As Frank grumbled about medical politics, the coffee warmed me and I relaxed. We began to discuss the morning. "I've referred Jade Price to the community paediatrician. Possible child abuse. I didn't tell the mother I would at the time, so I'm going round to the house later today." Frank listened to the story, eyes wary.
"I know the Prices. Be careful, Jenny, and look from all angles. They don't strike me as abusive."
"There aren't that many angles," I said, remembering the bruises and Jade's exhausted stillness. "The family profile fits. Her father's an alcoholic bully. Her mother's depressed."
"Why go round? You could simply phone."
"It will be difficult to tell her I suspect the family of child abuse. I can pick my moment better face to face." I paused as another thought occurred to me. There might be more clues at the house as well.
"Do you want me to come with you?"
"What? Why?"
"They could run rings round you, or get nasty. You seem a bit preoccupied. I mean, not just about this. Something's ruffling the feathers.
Frank hadn't been a family doctor for 30 years for nothing.
Oh, you know, family stuff.
Ted okay?
Fine, mostly. A star in the ascendant, in fact.
Remembering the glimmer last night, the excitement that had shone from him.
Kids? My favourite godchild.
Name is changed. Quieter, I think. Can't quite put my finger on it.
As I said this, a pulse of worry thumped in my head.
What was I missing?
Up to something, I expect, he grinned. 15-year-old girls spend their lives up to something.
She usually tells me.
Not lately, though, not for weeks. Months, even. Knowing Naomi, she will in her own time. What does Ted say?
Hasn't. Well, I didn't run it by him. Too much happening.
I smiled ruefully.
We always run out of time. One of us goes to sleep.
God knows how you do it all. I've only got one, and Kathy's at home all the time.
I didn't like it when people said that. As if I must be cheating. There was no magic. It wasn't even difficult. I just had to keep going, and I knew exactly how to do that. Sometimes it felt as though I was escaping from one life to another and back again. I wasn't sure exactly what I was escaping from each time, but it seemed to work. I told my friends it gave me a built-in excuse if something went wrong. Over time, I'd realised that if it meant I had to leave the children to sort themselves out, they usually did. Now I had only myself to blame if Naomi was learning to be independent. I'd wait until her guard was down and she was ready to talk. I'd overlook the cigarette, then once she told me what the matter was, I would help. If anyone asked me, I would say she was happy, that Ted and I were as well. I would say we were all perfectly happy. The Price's house was in a road near the docks, a mile or so from the practice. The area near the river had been reconstructed. The old warehouses were now brick and glass offices and a gym. But the glamorous architecture didn't penetrate to the road the Prices lived on, a couple of streets back. I parked the car and walked, looking for number 14. One or two windows had broken glass patched up with cardboard. In a front garden, there was a television set leaning into the mud. None of the doors seemed to have numbers. I stopped near a group of boys who were standing around a motorbike, the sleek machine at odds with the street. The boys were thin, shoulders up against the bitter wind. One of them sucked at a can, tilting it high, carelessly, so the fluid fell on his face. A yellowing sheet of newspaper blew against my legs. I pulled it off and let it go, watching as it flapped against the lamppost. I went closer to the group.
Hi, I'm looking for number 14.
The tallest boy jerked his head up.
Jeff Price, what for?
A smaller boy stepped forward, shifting his weight from side to side, a roll-up gripped in his teeth, bare white arms tightly folded. He jerked his head silently at a house with a yellow door.
Thanks for your help.
I smiled quickly at them all.
Upper self, isn't she? Someone said as I turned away, and one of them threw his can into the road.
There were bottles outside the yellow door. Some had fallen over. My feet tapped a pile on the step, sending them crashing to the path, and a small wave of laughter hit against my back. The door was slightly ajar, and the smell of urine and beer reached outside. The bell didn't work, so I knocked. There was no answer. I pushed the door wider, stepped inside the narrow, dark hall, and called,
"Hello, Mrs. Price? It's the doctor from yesterday."
"Who's this, then?"
A huge man emerged from the darkness down the narrow hall. His stained dressing gown gaped, revealing a mat of greying chest hair and baggy underpants. As he came barreling down the corridor towards me, my hands tightened on my bag.
"The doctor, I'm the doctor."
"Oh yeah? What might you be after?"
"Your wife brought Jade to see me yesterday."
The change was sudden and complete. His mouth opened in a wide smile, and his eyes widened.
Bless you, love. I'm dead worried about her and all. Come in, meet Mother.
I would tell him soon. After I had met his mother, I would warn him I was worried about his daughter being abused, though I might not use that word. I would tell him that I had referred her, for safety's sake. He gestured me down the hall and through a narrow door at the end.
Say hello to the doctor, Mar. She's come about our little Jady.
The smell of ammonia made my eyes water. An old lady sat close to the fire, where a thin bar of red glowed. An ancient parrot of a woman, with eyes sunk in dry folds of skin and thin claws gripping the arms of the chair. Her limbs writhed, and her cheeks bulged rhythmically in constant chewing. Under her seat, the carpet looked dark and wet.
She can't help it. I'll make us a nice cup of tea. Make yourself comfy, love.
I looked for somewhere to sit, but every surface was crowded. Foil tablet sheets, balls of paper handkerchiefs rolled up together with dark green deposits gummed in the creases. Plastic toys littered the floor and were shoved under the television. There was a child's painting of a house stuck to the wall. The heat and the smell were intense. I went into the hall and listened. I could hear the kettle whistling, rattling crockery, the sound of something smashing, and curses from Mr. Price. I looked up the narrow stairs that twisted into darkness. I was listening for a child, but I didn't have time to hear anything.
Looking for me, love?
Mr. Price appeared, steaming mugs in each hand. He followed me back into the sitting room, his hard stomach pushing me ahead.
Here we are, Ma.
He balanced a mug for me on a pile of newspapers, blew noisily into another, then tilted his mother's chin and spooned tea into her mouth. Brown dribbles ran down her chin and onto her pink nylon nightdress. Next to her chair there was a family photo. From where I was sitting, I could make out the small shape of a child, dwarfed by her parents either side.
About Jade.
Yeah?
I'm worried about her bruises.
Tracy told me. This cough. She feels hot sometimes, you know, properly sweaty. And she's off her food, getting thinner. All the bruises.
I wondered how she got them.
I watched him intently as I said this.
That's just it. We haven't got a clue. Not a dicky bird.
That's part of the reason I want to send her to the hospital for a checkup. The bruises.
Hospital? Fuck me. You think it's serious, then?
His forehead wrinkled. He sounded genuinely worried, and I saw what Frank meant. This man could run rings round me.
Anything we don't understand is important. I kept my voice level. I want her checked out by a paediatrician.
Oh, yeah? And who's that when he's at home?
A children's doctor. Someone to look into the problems that happen when children have injuries we don't understand. Like Jade. To be honest, we are worried in case she's been hurt by someone.
Those bloody little blighters at school!
I'd tried. I'd tried hard enough. If I forced a confrontation, he might take her and vanish.
They'll send her an appointment, or they may ring if they see a space coming up in the next day or two.
Thanks, Doc.
His face creased in a smile that looked convincing.
I'll tell the wife.
I stood up, ignoring the tea. His mother jerked and writhed silently in her seat.
It's okay. She's going.
Mr. Price leant towards his mother, shouting in her ear,
Say goodbye to the doctor.
The parrot eyes flicked in my direction. She knew. You couldn't live in a house with a child who was being hurt and not know. She probably guessed exactly why I was here. The gang of boys was still there. One of them held a bag to his face. Another was lolling against the lamppost, swaying slightly, eyes closed. Two were squatting, heads low, hands dangling. They didn't see me pass. The narrow street was darker. The strip of sky looked grey-green, and it had begun to rain lightly. I checked my watch as I hurried. 4 p.m. Theo would be in the art studio, arranging his photos for the exhibition. Ed would be rowing for school team practice, serious-eyed, muscles straining. They were about the same age as this group of boys. But I didn't feel lucky. I felt afraid. It was cold in the car, and I turned the heater and the radio on. The local news was being read. Rapist attacks inner Bristol. Flooding. Chocolate factory closing down. Suddenly I wanted to speak to Ted. I wanted to hear his voice. I turned the radio off, pulled out my mobile and tapped his number. His voice told me he was unavailable, to leave a message after the tone. This was different from the last answering message, one he had recorded at home, when there had been a faint backwash of music, a pan crashing, and children's voices. This was just his voice, clear and confident. He sounded very sure of himself, and very far away. 6. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. I enclose the old lady's thin wrist with my fingers. Hers is an image I have gathered in without knowing, like a tree by the road that I often drive past. She has until now been no more than a bent shape in a bulky coat. I'd known she was old by her stiff, dipping gait. Sometimes in the long, slow hours of night, I look out of my window and see a comforting point of light from her bedroom window. Now she is lying at an awkward angle, her neck is wedged against the doorpost, her arms have fallen across her body, hands bunched. Hello? Can you hear me? No answer. Does it hurt anywhere? Nothing. I'm going to lift you up. Hold on. I slide one arm under her shoulders and the other under her splayed knees. Close up, her white skin is finely wrinkled. There are brown blotches on her cheeks. Her thin lips are pale, and her white hair drawn back so tightly the bones of her forehead are outlined. She has the look of a sleeping cat, and she weighs no more than a little girl. As I push her door wider open with my shoulders, I am back to doing what I used to do every day, when looking after people was a routine part of life. Bristol, 2009. 15 to 10 days before. The days passed quickly. Ordinary days. Were they ordinary? It seemed so at the time. In my memory, they remain just that. Grey-blue days of routine and little dramas. Ordinary, even though they were the last days of family life. Ordinary, though it turned out that almost everyone was lying. I worked in the practice, routine antenatal clinics and daily surgeries. At home, Ted and I talked, argued, made love when we weren't too exhausted. Ed had a couple of days off with a bad cold, and I left him undisturbed and sleeping on those mornings, drinks and paracetamol on his bedside table. Theo got a commendation for his Woodland photo series, and Naomi's rehearsals were more frequent and lasted longer. Ted spent more time at work. His paper was accepted by The Lancet. We celebrated late at night with a bottle of wine. If the days felt ungraspable as one slid into the next, at least life was running smoothly onwards. The trick was simply to balance it all. Family, marriage, career, painting. If the balance tipped in one direction and work took up more time, no one complained. It sometimes felt as if I was rehearsing for real life, so if it went wrong, it didn't matter. One day, I would have it all organized. I would be the perfect mother, wife, doctor, artist. It was just simply a question of practice. If I made mistakes, I could simply try again. At work, there was always a fresh sense of starting over. Every morning, the basin was clean. New blue paper lay on the couch. The toys had been tidied away into the box underneath. Jade was admitted to hospital, on Thursday the 5th of November. In her letter, the paediatrician's secretary had mentioned Mr. Price. He'd thrown chairs in the waiting room and broken a window. The police were called and he'd been arrested. I had handed the load on, so I tried to put it from my mind, but I couldn't shake the image of his face when I had told him I had come about Jade's referral. He had seemed so pleased. I decided it was simply that he knew he had been out of control and was relieved that someone was going to stop him. The following Monday, I got to the surgery early for the quiet space before the patients arrived. I checked the results while I was sipping my first mug of coffee, and Mrs. Blacking's liver function test was still on the screen when the phone rang.
Dr. Malcolm?
Yes? I wedged the phone under my chin as I scrolled down. There were red dots by all the liver enzymes on the screen. My hunch had been right. The thin hair, red palms, and the spidery veins on her cheeks had given her away. The forgetfulness wasn't just the menopause. She hadn't told me about the bottle of sherry at the back of the cupboard, the one she probably bought with the milk from Tesco's every day. I sent an email to Jo to ask her to make Mrs. Blacking an appointment.
From the Children's Hospital.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch.
Dr. Chisholm, paediatric consultant from the Children's Hospital. You referred Jade Price.
I put the mug down and held the phone properly.
Yes, I did. Thank you for... I would like to talk about the case with you, Dr. Malcolm.
I was glad he was taking this seriously, but there wasn't time now.
Perhaps I could phone you back later this morning. My surgery begins in 3 minutes. I'd prefer to talk to you in person. I'm free at 1. I've cancelled a meeting.
I told myself I needed him, so I had to be polite.
1 today? I'll have to see if that's possible. Please, it would be helpful. My office is on the 5th floor of the Children's Hospital. I'll ask Frank, Dr. Dracup, my partner. Perhaps he can... Good. See you later.
I could see this consultant very clearly. He had wings of grey hair, perfectly brushed. He'd be holding the x-rays in a large, freckled hand, looking at them through silver-rimmed glasses, nodding at the old spiral fractures, the footprint of child abuse. He wouldn't be thinking about my day, the phone calls and the visits to hidden flats down roads where parking was impossible. He wouldn't know about the referrals, the scripts to sign, the feeling of lateness, and the struggle to fit it all in before the end of the day. He wanted to talk to me about Jade, and because I could help, I knew I had to go. At 1 precisely, I tapped the door with Dr. Chisholm spelt out in neat gold lettering in a little black frame. He stood up as I went in. He was thin and dark, with intense brown eyes that watched mine closely so that he caught the flicker of surprise.
It's okay. Everyone is fooled. Sadly, I lost my Ghanaian accent at Oxford.
His handshake was tight and brief.
Thank you for coming. Sit, please.
I sat down on a grey plastic chair, and he took his place behind the desk. It felt like an interview somehow. I spoke quickly.
Thank you for asking me to meet you. It's a difficult situation. Jade is ill, Dr. Malcolm.
Yes. Her father didn't give anything away, but I think it's been going on for a while. She seems very depressed on top of it all.
Very ill.
He looked at me without expression.
The social workers... She has leukemia.
His voice cut smoothly across mine.
Leukemia?
I was confused. Or perhaps he was. He must be talking about another child. His voice was continuing.
So we are certain no one abused her. Unwashed, maybe. Lice and so on. Unwitting neglect from inadequate parents, though I suspect she is loved. No. She has acute lymphoblastic leukemia.
Jesus.
Blood tests show atypical lymphocytes, blast cells, no clotting capacity. She is dangerously anemic.
How the hell had I missed that?
Everything was suddenly, shatteringly obvious.
She had been passive with exhaustion, not because she was depressed, but because she was anemic. The chest infection was secondary to non-functioning white cells. The bruises were due to poor clotting. She had come back 4 times, and I hadn't listened, hadn't believed her mother. A hot wave of guilt was breaking over me. Dr. Chisholm kept pace with my thoughts and outstripped them.
We have her on intravenous antibiotics. The MRI scan is booked for tomorrow, and then we start the chemotherapy.
Do her parents know?
Not yet. That's why I wanted to see you. It's a delicate situation. In clinic, I told them we needed to admit her to investigate the possibility of non-accidental injury. They asked if that's what you had thought.
I went to their house specially to inform them. But that was a mistake. I knew that now. I had judged them partly by their house, by the street it was in. I tried to tell her father.
People choose to hear what they want to.
His eyes flashed before he looked away.
I have no doubt you tried your best, Dr. Malcolm, but I'm afraid they had no idea at all.
Mr. Price felt accused. He was angry. Angry? He would want to kill. The suspicion had fallen on him because of me. I could see that bull-like figure hurling the chair through the window in helpless rage.
The tests came back this morning. From here on, we take over. I knew this would be a surprise, so I thought I would tell you myself. I also wondered if you wanted to inform her parents. It might be best in the long run for you to discuss the diagnosis with them at this point. Build trust.
Discuss? What was there to say? That I had made a terrible mistake because I hadn't believed what they were saying? That I had stereotyped them in the worst possible way? His eyes looked hard into mine. I couldn't tell if he was sympathetic or contemptuous. What's the prognosis?
Between 20% and 75% 5-year survival.
We have to wait for the scan results. Jade has an unusually large number of abnormal white cells in her bloodstream, which worsens her prognosis, as you know. He was still watching me closely.
So, as her first point of contact, what do you want to do?
I wanted to run away from the guilt that could drown me. I had referred Jade in the end, but for the wrong reasons, and too late, months too late. I'll go and see her parents, of course. I thought for a moment and added, I'd like to see Jade. At least I can tell them how she is.
Follow me.
He moved smoothly from his desk, through the door, and out into the corridor. I almost had to run to keep up. She looked all right, I'd say to her parents later. She looked better. It wouldn't be long, I'd tell them. It's lucky she's in hospital now. She was laughing. No, perhaps not laughing. She was smiling, I said. Then she laughed. I wasn't sure at first why we had stopped at the second bed. There was a little boy in it, very thin, with closed eyes and spiky fair hair. He looked about 6. There was a drip in the arm that lay outside the sheet. Then I saw the giraffe, dirty against the crisp white linen. Some of the bruises were green now, but there were new red and mauve ones too. We cut her hair to make it easier to get rid of the lice, he spoke very quietly, but it will also help her adjust to the hair loss. We had her permission, and the permission of her parents, though, as I say, they don't know the diagnosis. I wondered how long before she would go completely bald with the chemotherapy. Dr. Chisholm was talking softly. It was as if he'd read my thoughts. We don't yet know what combination of drugs we will use. That will depend on the scan.
Jade? I whispered. Hello there. It's the doctor.
Dr. Chisholm looked at me. His eyes said, Doctor? The doctor? Jade has met lots of doctors now. He sounded dismissive. She's asleep. I ignored him.
Jade, I'm going to see your mum and dad now. I'll give them...
What? What would I tell them? Was there anything to give them? Her eyelids flickered open. Maybe it was because she had heard my voice before, or maybe it was because she heard me say mum and dad. But for a second, less than a second, she looked at me, and she smiled. It was only as I turned the car on the oily concrete of the hospital underground car park that it came to me. Of course, she couldn't have known that it was my fault, or that she might have been helped so much earlier, if only I had listened. 7. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. I am immediately in a warm kitchen, tidy and teeming with colour. I take in orange patterned lino, a dark red table, yellow units with white handles, a bright blue stove, and a red sofa by the wall. A fire is glowing. A television screen flickers from the corner. Several large embroidered cats crowd on a chintz-covered armchair. Bertie has followed us in. Before I can stop him, he eats the small squashed pile of cat food in a bowl and then settles by the fire with a little grunting sigh. I put the old lady down on the sofa, slide off her shoes, then sit next to her. With my hand on her pulse, I scan the room quickly. There are photos on all the surfaces, an elderly man wearing a cap, digging in a garden, a dark-haired young woman with a baby, a small boy at the edge of the sea holding another child's hand, family everywhere. I am taken back to our kitchen at home, so steeped in family that I used to think if I pressed my ear against the wall, I would hear the children's voices stored inside. When everything began to go wrong, going home was all I could think about. Bristol, 2009. 10 days before. I drove away from the hospital as fast as I could, overtaking a learner driver and then jumping forward at a crossroads before the lights changed. As I accelerated down Park Road, little groups of words slid and twisted away in my mind. I thought the bruises... There was never long enough... I know you told me... I'm sorry. I rarely returned this early. The front door had been left open. Ed's trainers discarded just inside. He must have come rushing back for something he'd forgotten. I picked them up. He didn't really need to take his shoes off, because we'd taken the carpets out years ago. No curtains either. The rooms were empty spaces, the sun streaming through the pristine glass of great sash windows, lay on the dark wooden floors in unfamiliar lines. It was usually dark when I got home. There was a piano here, walls of books, and a refectory table so Ted could spread out his papers easily. Now my footsteps sounded hollow as I walked through the echoing rooms. Despite their ordered perfection, we hardly used them. Ted always worked in his study. The children lived in their bedrooms or the kitchen. I went down the wooden stairs to the basement kitchen, and the warmth rose to meet me. I held the trainers closely against me. Too closely, because later I saw they had left an uneven, muddy smear across my shirt. Ed was sitting in front of the computer in the living space that opened off the kitchen. As I walked over to see him, a screen folded down into the corner, and another came up, full of numbers. I was so pleased to see him, I felt slightly dizzy. I sat down near him on the arm of the sofa. I wanted to kiss his cheek, which always smelt of warm toast, and rest my hand on his springy dark hair. He winced away as I approached. I had to learn new rules all the time. "Hi, darling," I spoke to his back. "You're home early."
"Maths coursework."
He didn't look at me.
"Ed, I'm only saying..." "Lessons cancelled. There's a talk about that rapist."
"Yes?" He kept his eyes on the screen.
"I gave it a miss. It's for the girls. How not to walk home on your own, how not to talk to strangers. Tedious."
"What did they say about the rapist? Why today? Something else to worry about. He's the other side of Bristol, isn't he?"
"Christ, questions?" His fist was clenched on the table. "Some teacher thought they saw a random bloke lurking about the girls' boarding house."
He looked at me quickly, eyes screwed up, hiding something.
"I need to get this done. I'm way past the deadline."
"Hot chocolate?"
"Yeah, okay."
I made it quickly.
As I put it in front of him, I let my hand rest on his shoulder for a second. Close up, I was surprised that he smelt stale. I hesitated, and he glanced up, frowning.
"Thought you were normally at work," he muttered.
"Well, I am, normally."
"Doing a bunk?"
The dark eyebrows lifted. His attention was snagged. I was startled. "Course not. Are you?"
"Told you. It's just a talk for the girls. Once I've done this, I'm back on track."
"Okay, good." I wanted to tell him then that you can spin off track so easily. One mistake and you've lost your way. I let myself sit close to him for a few minutes, absorbing his aura, the tall frame slouched in the chair, large feet with crumpled socks, and the smooth back of his neck. He turned to look at me again, checking, not used to my stillness. I started to explain. "Work things are a bit... I'm a bit stuck on something."
"Yeah?"
Shoulders hunched, eyes wary. "It's all right, though. I'm sorting it." The broad shoulders relaxed.
"Only I need to finish..."
"Fine." I picked up the trainers again. "These are yours, darling. They'll need a wash. And Ed, don't forget to chuck your clothes in the wash sometimes as well." He took the shoes, gave a little grunt. His face moved close to the screen again. I patted his shoulder briefly and moved away. In the kitchen, I made a cup of tea and looked at the garden through the curling steam. The trunks were fused in the darkening light. I phoned Ted and this time got through. He listened.
"God, that's hard for you," he said when I paused. "Sorry, Jen."
"Don't be sorry for me. Be sorry for Jade."
"I've done the same. Worse. Remember what happened with that young girl's spine? Paralyzed. Terrible."
"Yes, of course. That was terrible," I agreed. That mistake had almost led to a court case. Ted's guilt had deepened into depression. For a second, I felt ashamed. I hadn't thought then to give him the comfort I needed now. "But everyone knows the risks of neurosurgery," I said after a little pause. "They sign consent forms. You explain things. The Prices didn't realize there was a risk in trusting me, and I never thought about leukemia. I didn't manage to hear anything that they said." I stopped, remembering how I had ignored what they had told me, allowing my thoughts to spin off in a different direction.
"I'm in the middle of something, Jenny," he said quickly. "I can't talk now. I'll try to get home early. I'll get some wine."
After surgery that evening, I phoned the Prices. No one answered. Frank and I had arranged to visit them the following morning, but I decided to go now anyway. The street was empty. The windows of number 14 were dark. I knocked, waited, knocked again. I pictured Mar inside, listening, writhing in her seat in the dark. After a while, I went home. That night, the boys were at a careers talk, and Naomi at her play rehearsal. It was just Ted and me. We shared the bottle of wine and sat for a long time over the empty plates. Ted held my hand, and the warmth crept into my wrist. "What shall I say to them, Ted?"
"Tell them the truth. You went on the evidence in front of you. It's all we can ever do."
"She said she didn't know about the bruises. So did he, but I didn't believe them. They both told me about the cough. That was the evidence, but I had made up my mind already."
"We're not lawyers, Jenny. There isn't always time to weigh things up, not on a first meeting."
"It wasn't the first meeting. Anyway, we do behave like lawyers. We make judgments all the time."
"Judgments?"
"The Prices were guilty of being poor, of not being able to tell me clearly, or at least in language I understood or believed. Guilty of having a bruised child. Now they're being punished."
"You have to go by instinct sometimes."
He leant over and kissed me deeply. I tried to turn away, but his lips held me, his tongue pushing, nudging in. He wasn't listening either. Going by instinct wasn't enough. I pulled my head away. Because of my preconceptions, I hadn't referred her early enough, and then when I eventually did, It was on the basis of the wrong diagnosis. Instinct had failed me completely. The boys and Naomi came back. The boys ate quickly and went upstairs, catching up with work. Naomi shrugged off my questions about the rapists. The girls went about in groups, she said, and were checked in everywhere. She leant against the table, eating spoonfuls of leftover gratin dauphinoise that were stuck to the edges of the dish in front of us. She answered us between mouthfuls. The rehearsals were going brilliantly. The teachers were talking about drama school. Her expression was inward, secret. Possibilities were obviously beginning to unfurl. I watched her guarding her thoughts and decided not to push her with more questions. I was too tired anyway to focus on her answers. After a while, she went upstairs. Ted and I silently did the dishes and tidied food away. I put the last load of washing on. We walked upstairs, side by side, hands touching. My legs moved slowly, heavy with exhaustion. Halfway up, Ted put his arm round me, pulling me in. By the time I reached the landing, my breath was coming quickly. The children had gone to sleep, so we talked in whispers. I forced myself to strip, shower, put on a new nightdress, comforted by its softness and lace. Ted came up beside me as I stood at the mirror. They say you marry someone who looks like you, but I've never seen it. Ted was tall and broad with a blue stare. I came up to his shoulders, and my Irish grandmother looked back at me with the face from the photos in our family album. Dark curly hair, light eyes, freckles. Ted looked at me in the mirror, and the hand on my neck tightened. His fingertips felt hot, widely splayed under the edge of my hair. In bed, we turned to each other wordlessly. I was ready for his mouth now.